Hey, everybody, welcome to the New World Pictures Podcast bonus episode. We've got a great interview lined up for you. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
This is an exciting interview, at least for me, because it's one of those times that you get a peek behind the curtains of what was happening in those later years at New World Pictures. What happened in those last couple years?
And Erica.
Yes.
And yes, Mark is right. We are closing out Sci-Fi July presents Dystopian Summer. And we're talking to two people that worked at New World Pictures in the trailer department. Now, there's been a lot of, obviously, people know when they think of New World Pictures and they think of Alan Arkush and Joe Dante working in the trailer department. But these are guys that worked in the trailer department of the New World, the people that bought New World Pictures from Roger Corman. And so we're going to hear their stories working at New World Pictures and towards the end of New World Pictures and what that was like. It is a fascinating and amazing conversation with our guest, Kevin Sewelson, who also not only edited trailers, but he is the editor of In the Aftermath. So, of course, we're really here to discuss what is In the Aftermath. Also with Kevin as well is Dave Parker. Dave Parker, we've been trying to get him on the show for a long time. He was a longtime trailer editor for New World Pictures. He has seen it all, and you will hear it from him. These guys were absolutely terrific. We could not have gotten along better. We had so much fun chatting with them about New World Pictures. This is a fascinating conversation, and I'm not going to talk anymore. You should listen to it. Here we are talking to Kevin Sewelson and Dave Parker.
I'm curious what got, if I can ask a question. I know
you're
sure.
Please. Sure.
What got you guys interested in New World
stuff? I had the same question.
It's a long story, but we've been into New World for a long time. And certainly growing up, like going to video stores and stuff, New World was always, you know, stuff that it was one of those symbols that you recognized, you know, like the whole New World symbol and, you know, like Canon and some of those other companies, but New World was just one of those that stood out. And then, Mark, I will turn it to you. You built a like New World website for a time, like in the 90s, where we were going to we were going to review all the New World movies and catalog them on the website.
All of them?
Yeah. What? Well, I mean, at the time, I think we thought that that was a less extensive
so there was this was during a period of time that we had been living in San Francisco, and we would go to the Tower Records had an outlet store that they sold basically surplus videos that they had rented in their rental locations. And at the time, you could buy all kinds of New World movies that we'd never heard of for $3-4. Sure. So we started buying all of these and just watching all of them. So, or the ones we could get our hands on. So this is sort of very early internet. And so we created a website where we were going to just type up reviews of all these New World movies. Wow. And we did it for a while and ran out of the ability to access the full catalog. So fast forward to 2017. And we thought, hey, let's try jumpstarting that idea again, but we'll make it as a podcast. Now, admittedly, we didn't recognize or realize at the time how many movies New World Pictures made. we thought we'll do this for a couple years. We'll get through some of the deep cuts and some of the bigger hits, and we'll wrap it up. And I think that we have only now 5 years in scratch the surface of the catalog that New World Pictures produced.
Certainly the Corman stuff.
That was my next question. It's like, are you focused on the Corman era or the 1,000 films that New World put out straight to video post-Corman?
It is all New World stuff. So Corman era, the second ownership group, the third ownership group when it, you know, was basically a bunch of TV stations in the 90s, like for part of the 90s where they were just doing New World Television. So New World Television, New World Video, New World Pictures, New World International, New World Mutual, when they were distributing in Canada, like we're just
catching. Yeah, there were New World Entertainment when they in the 90s, right? I think it was
right. Yeah, right. It was sort of they. I don't think they released things under New World Entertainment, but that was like what they sort of set up the that was the main company, and then everything was an offshoot off of that.
Yeah, New World was basically dead at 89, 90. Whenever the junk bond market collapsed is when New World went away, because that was all their financing was all junk bonds with those guys.
Yeah.
And when that went away, and with the video home video market kind of going topsy-turvy, where you go to the video store and you could actually rent a real movie, you didn't really want to rent, you know, Death Before Dishonor. So
right,
kind of killed their whole the whole home video idea.
Wait, Death Before Dishonor is not a real movie?
That's Fred Meyer, he can act.
Well, Dave and I, along with a few other people, probably cut trailers for every one of those movies between 85 and 89.
Yeah, I was there at the end. I think you left before I did.
Did I?
Yeah, I think so. I was there to the bitter end.
You were there till they wouldn't let you in the door anymore?
Pretty much.
Till they kicked you out. You're like, I have to finish Under the Boardwalk's trailer. And they're like, it's over. It's over. I just get out.
I cut Under the Boardwalk trailer.
Oh, okay.
Nice.
Okay, so you were there nearly to the very end, but
well, I don't know what year that was. Was that 90 or 89?
I think that was 89. That would have been the last theatrical movie that New World released, at just following Heathers.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay, so I was there for that. I must have left very shortly after that. It's hard to remember. That's now 37 years ago.
Crazy.
Yeah, that's a long time ago. So we have to get our brain juices going here to pull this all together.
Well, and for what it's worth, one of our frequent guests, and one of the people that we started watching all these New World movies with, had a framed poster of Under the Boardwalk in his apartment for years. Yes, absolutely loved that movie.
Yeah. He was my old college roommate, and when I moved in, I was a year ahead of him, and when he had moved in a day before me, he had nothing but this is the 90s. He had nothing but Nine Inch Nails posters and then one Tough Turf poster.
I had a lot of posters from him, but I want to give you a quote from Under the Boardwalk. It's okay to surf all your life, just don't be a surfer all your life.
Yeah. I remember that.
Classic.
Was that in the trailer?
Yes, it was in the trailer.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, you can't let that gold go.
I have a Creepshow 2 trailer or a poster.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That was your first trailer, right, Dave?
That was my first TV spot. It was a 60 for cable. It was a cut down of the trailer.
I didn't do the trailer. I think I did TVs on that. Or maybe I did the trailer. It's very hard to remember. There were so many projects.
Well, let's jog your memories. Let's go back to the beginnings of how you guys got involved in New World. So,
go ahead, Kevin, you were first.
Yeah, Kevin. So how did you get started?
It was just a freak chance. I had gone to school in Oregon and studied telecommunications and film at the U of O, University of Oregon. Came to LA. I got a job on a low-budget feature called 315. We were doing pickups for this low-budget feature in downtown L.A., and the sound guys were there, and they hired me as an assistant sound editor. When that film was over, we were in Raleigh Studios, and the head guy of that team told me there was a job available up on the top floor of the old Charlie Chaplin building for New World Pictures. He said they need a runner. Mm-hmm. Now, I almost didn't take that job. I went up there and I met with two of the head guys there, Mark Pierce and Jim Melkonian, and they hired me. I think it was, $50 a week or something, or a day. I don't remember.
$50 a day is what I got hired at. Yeah,
$50 a day, not a week. $50 a day. And I took the job. And what New World was at that time was probably anywhere from 10 to 15 moviolas in one giant room with everybody cutting. And I was running and I was doing, you know, all kinds of things, ancillary things. And I met a guy there who was working on, a guy named Mike Spence was working on Godzilla 1985.
Right. Yeah.
And he brought me in as his assistant editor on that film. And I learned a lot of ropes from him. And pretty soon they gave me a room and a chem, and I cut a trailer for a movie called Cut and Run. And that was my very, very first trailer. And I did, from then, this was a trailer factory. It was like it sounded like a sewing factory in there with all the moviolas running at the same time, everybody with headphones on and moviolas. And so I got that job, and that started my career as a trailer editor.
Now, when you started, you got in editing Godzilla 85 as his assistant. So you
that was a feature assistant, yes.
Right, right. But you had been sort of being a runner, and then you got kind of brought in to help him out to edit the movie. What do you remember from working on Godzilla 85? Because we spoke to RJ Kaiser earlier this year.
I remember learning a lot about effects, about digital effects. They shot Raymond Burr there on the lot to incorporate him into that film. Now, this was a big thing that New World used to do, obviously, in the aftermath as well, is they would buy these foreign films, maybe that weren't as marketable as they could potentially be without some, you know, American spin influence on them. And I learned about really breaking down, analyzing a film, figuring out what works and what doesn't work. And Michael Spence was extremely helpful and an amazing teacher. And he taught me how to really look at a film and how to figure out what works and what doesn't. And it's not just technical. It's about what your objective is. You're trying to appeal to a different audience than it was originally made for. Now, this is a direct application to Angel's Egg in the aftermath.
Sure, sure.
Even more so, and as we get into talking about that film.
Right, right. But Godzilla 85, though, is like, do you know if they were planning to, they were thinking there was going to be a big, they wanted it to be big in theaters, right? Like they, it becomes a much bigger success on video, but there was a big ad campaign. They had Dr. Pepper.
They spent money on that film. I think it was because of, you know, having the budget to bring in Raven Burr and doing all that. Mm-hmm. They were spending money. They expected that they could have, you know, an awesome American release of a Godzilla film. I don't have any idea what it did theatrically or how wide it was released theatrically. I don't remember, but for me, I was 29 years old. I was immersed in this world of editing and it took me over creatively. I wasn't thinking in my later career, obviously, I had a motion picture advertising agency for about 25 years. So I did movie trailer campaigns. So I learned a lot more about objectives and all that. But this was a creative world. Creative world, 100%. And so in that sense, it was brilliant. Yeah. It was really, really a cool place to be.
So when you go, did you go from Godzilla 85 then into cutting trailers?
Yes.
Okay.
I did, yeah.
And because Michael Spence was also doing that too, right? Like that's what he was doing.
Michael was cutting trailers. Yeah.
He was also a feature. He did Silent Night, Deadly Night. That's his, and he directed part of that too. I just watched some documentary on the disc and he was on it talking about how he had to take over and directed a few scenes in that movie, which is crazy. But he's a really cool guy and a really, really good.
Really, really cool guy. We became very close friends.
Yeah, He's a hard guy to track down. I think he's doing a lot of painting now.
He is. He's in Seattle. I spoke with him about just before I came to Hawaii, and we had this awesome reconnect. And he and his very long-term wife took off out of L.A. and moved to Seattle, and I moved to Hawaii. So, but I love the guy. He's great. He really was a big influence to everybody there. Michael was
absolutely.
Michael was a significant creative force, and had knowledge. He was sort of, you know, more. He was older, and he was a little more mature than I was for sure. You know, I was having a lot of fun,
right?
And Michael really sort of took the lead, and so yes, trailers started after that. I cut, I don't know how many trailers for New World, and I did also do a few features for this guy named Ram Punjabi, who had a company in Indonesia and was bringing films over to New World. And then I did, what did I do, Dave? No Retreat, No Surrender.
No Retreat, No Surrender, right? Two?
Yeah.
Or
two. Yep.
Number two. I was going to ask you about that because somehow New World released the first one, but the second one and the third one, somehow they went to Shapiro Glickenhaus. So I don't know why that happened.
I don't know why they sold them. They must have, but I did edit.
The second one.
Yeah.
Kevin, did you work on Warriors of the Wind?
No.
You guys know that one?
Yeah. It's another Japanese anime that...
Right.
That New World cut.
By Miyazaki.
Was that a Miyazaki film?
Yeah, and he after that experience, he's like, I'm never letting anyone touch my movies again. It was so horrible, apparently.
I think he had it in his contract that he was like, I won't allow anyone to cut my movies.
Because of that movie.
Wow. Yeah,
you didn't work on that one, did you, Dave?
Oh, God, no, that was before my time. I didn't get there until 87.
Okay, so when you get hired there, was Michael Spence working there, or did he hire you? Or
he was still there. I mean, they were still at Rally Studios at the time, but when I started is when we moved over to Lionsgate over in West LA.
Right.
So the post-production had West LA, and all the suits were over on Sepulveda, which was great because the whole post-production was like it was its own entity and just a really great group of people. And we didn't have to worry about the suits because they were 10 minutes away, which could have been, you know, 2 hours away. They're not coming over to see us. So it was great because Spence taught me how to take 3-hour lunches. It was just so much fun there because you weren't anywhere near the bullshit. So it would take a while to trickle down to us. So we were kind of
separated from the corporate office. But I'll tell you this about the Lionsgate location. We used to live there.
Yeah.
Some people lived there.
Yeah.
And slept on couches. We, you know, this was no playground. Mm-hmm. We worked around the clock.
Huh.
Kevin, did you hear about the radon thing?
Oh, yeah, the radon.
So we were in the basement of Lionsgate, all the cutting, and at one point, one of the guys bought one of those things you can measure how much radon you're getting, you know, x-rays. And apparently there was so much going in, we were getting like 1 to 3 x-rays a day.
Wow.
That's going to be fun later on in life.
I'm still glowing. No, that place was a workhouse, and I never slept there, but I do remember sending someone out to pick up socks for me because I think I was leaning my socks up against the wall.
Yeah, many an all-nighter there.
From all-nighters not being able to go home, definitely watching the sun come up, although we were in the basement and we'd have to go outside to see that, but that was a workhorse place.
So this is Lionsgate Studio, which New World bought in May of 1986. Spent $4 million buying that.
And we moved in the beginning of 87. It was around January, February when I started, is when we moved over there.
We moved over around then, yeah. That was on Bundy.
Near Olympic?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Olympic, yeah.
Just a little north of Olympic.
Yeah. And was the money that New World bought that place for, was that because of like New World Video being a kind of it was an instant sort of success?
I'm telling you, the three guys who bought Sloan and whatever the other two guys cup in, it was all junk bonds. I mean, they were big junk bonds guy, and that's why there was an insane amount of money going around it at one point. And they had hit it big with Soul Man. Soul Man had been a really big thing for them. So all of a sudden they thought they were a real studio. So they just started throwing money around left and right.
Got it. Okay. Cause I was curious, cause that seems like a big studio to buy when you didn't really, I mean, space already, but you
know. It really wasn't. It was basically, this had what, a couple sound stages cabinet and then just cutting rooms.
It wasn't like a studio. There were maybe three sound stages, and then there were our offices in the basement in that building away from.
Yeah. But, there were no sets or anything.
Post offices like Pierce and Milconian and Colpert, they were all, that wasn't a very huge space.
No, that was like, it was like an industrial little space.
I think they were renting, they were renting out a lot of other space there. We had a certain part of that complex, but by no means took it over.
Yeah, that makes sense. Cause they must've been looking also at how Corman also had the lumber yard and was shooting movies in there. And they probably wanted to get their own studio space. So that makes sense.
Right. But yeah, they didn't have any sets. They never shot anything there. The closest I ever saw was when they were blowing up a body in the parking lot for Dead Heat, trying to like figure out how to do it. They didn't have, I don't think we shot anything there.
Well, there was very little shot to begin with. I mean, most stuff was pickups. They were originally
almost all of it.
Original films were farmed out to other locations and other studios and whatever deals they could get, you know. But that brings me back to another question. Really, being a creative person there, I really have no idea what. I mean, the model for New World was to produce low budget movies for direct to video, mm-hmm. and that was right when video became VHS became a very, very viable big industry.
Right.
And I don't know if they made money doing that. I don't know. I don't know if the costs, you know, were beneath their expenses.
Yeah, well, when Soul Man hit, like I said, they thought they were a real studio and they could make movies, so they made crap like 18 Again. And I remember being told by an executive that 18 Again was going to make $80 million. It was going to be huge. And we were just thinking, are you insane? Because George Burns, he's an old god. Everyone loves him. Like, well, he goes into a coma 10 minutes into the movie. And at the end, he wakes up. And you're like, that's not George Burns. Well, you're watching some kid with a cigar. And they were talking about how Charlie Schlatter was going to be huge. I remember the weekend it opened. That was in Westwood. And you know, you go to Westwood and you'd know how a movie would do because there'd be these massive lines, you know, RoboCop, whatever, big lines. I went by the 18 Again and there were like seven people outside. I'm like, damn, this thing is just going to tank. And it made like a $2 million. It was insane.
Ooh, nasty. That hurts.
They thought that was such a big movie.
Well, crazy. You know, all studios, when they produce something, have that expectation of it. Yeah. They can't have anything else.
Yeah, they can hire their own supply. It's just like, you're all right. I remember sister, I remember we had a memo that went out that it had a screening, and it was the screening went so great that everyone stood up and cheered and like, really? For sister?
When? At what point? Believe. What point did they cheer?
Exactly.
It's not like a happy, like, it doesn't have a big ending where you're like, yes, they did it. I mean, it's not that kind of movie.
You know what movie I liked? I liked Flowers in the Attic with Louise Fletcher. I did the trailer for that. Well, I did one of the trailers. Mike Spence actually did the original trailer, and then I did, I think, maybe International or something. But that movie actually was pretty good with Louise Fletcher, and it was a decent horror film.
I read the book in high school. It was all right. But I remember we had a problem with the trailer. The trailer came back from the MPAA and they said, you know, we're not going to let this out because you have a bare breast in it. And I'm like, listen, if there's a bare breast, we're going to know. Like, what are you talking about? And we ran the trailer like four or five times. We couldn't figure it out. And finally someone pointed out in the background of a shop, there's a statue. And the statue has a bare breast. Mm. And we're like, you gotta be kidding me. Like, okay.
Some eagle eye at the MPAA can spot a breast from a mile away.
Those old ladies found it.
They spend all day in screening rooms. They were just like, oh, boobs.
We purposely put things in that were crazy, knowing they would take them out to slip in other things. Like, if they go focus on this, maybe they'll forget about this.
Well, right. They care about the boobs on statues, but not Christy Swanson's sweet wig that she's wearing towards the end of that movie.
Yeah, the incest is fine, but you can't show a statue.
We used to look for those shots in movies.
We're so baffled. Like, what are you talking about? There's no breasts in this.
Right. But going back to other bad decisions, Dave, you were saying when you got there, that was after Tony Randall had left as the head of post-production.
Yes.
But they had hired somebody to be the head of post-production who was a guy that had been trying to sell New World on an editing system.
Exactly. And that's why, I mean, that was told, that's why Tony left. He's like, this guy was here last week trying to sell us a system. I'm not working for him. And they passed over a few other good people too. Let's just say he didn't have a lot of respect. He hired some really, he hired all his friends and they were all pretty good guys, but he just had no clue what was going on. And it was just, we always would have to bypass him to get things done. He just ignore him. Like, you know, let him a little bit of information so he can be a little in the loop, just kind of ignore him.
Okay.
But he did get very involved in the aftermath, which we'll get to.
Okay, but that's not Carl that we're talking about.
No, right? Carl. Carl was an international guy. And it was funny, I didn't realize he was my age. I was 23, 24 when I started, and he had gone to AFI. And so it was not Carl. He was not in charge of the post world. He was the international guy in post.
Okay. So, because I know he was head of post-production, but he was head of post-production for like international.
For international. Yeah. I don't know exactly what his title was. He was from Belgium. I think his family was in, cars or tires or something like that. But
he got financing for other movies from sources that his family had. And
yeah, his family was well off.
He was able to finance films after he left New World and
He went on to a great career, I think.
Yeah.
He started Cineville, and
Cineville.
I think he was
food and lodging was his. Delusion was the
Delusion was his first big movie he directed, which I think he was writing while he was at New World.
Dude,
right?
That's what I wanted to try to I wanted to get through is everyone at New World was doing something else because you know you're making money and you're learning. But I mean, there were so many companies that got started out of that place that were working on their companies before they left. So many people writing screenplays. It was insane.
There was very little corporate oversight.
None. There's none.
Because they were in a totally different building, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
If you worked on a movie, you could kind of ask for what credit, main title credit you wanted, and they'd give it to you.
it was ridiculous. It was still a school. I mean, it carried on the Corman tradition.
It was a school.
You know, I didn't work for Corman. I never met him, but I feel like I owe Corman, you know, my career in a lot of ways because he started New World. And that idea of hiring young people and paying them $50 a day, but then letting them do whatever the hell they wanted was him.
Was carried over. Yeah, somehow it was carried over. I don't know if there was a actual choice made.
Well, I don't think so.
To keep it that way. I think it kind of wound up that way.
You could get people cheap.
These guys are doing what they're doing, and we'll take their materials, and we'll give notes, and you'll fix things and change things. And we'll put these movies out.
Speaking of that, how did it work on a day-to-day basis? You're in the trailer department. We have some sense of how it was in Corman's day with, you know, Alan Arkish and Joe Dante. But, like, you guys are there in the trenches. Like, how exactly did it work? Like, did you guys just get assignments and you went to work? I mean, you said there was
We had four copywriters. We had Marshall Drazen, Lee Stein, Straw Wiseman, and Nelson Lyon. They were the four main copywriters, and you'd get put on a project and you'd work with one of those copywriters. Back in the day, you know, you had a lot of narration, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you would just work on it, and then I would work 2, 3, 4 projects at a time just because that's just the way it was. Plus, you know, when you're making $50 a day, you want that overtime. So
I think we were making more than $50 a day at that point.
Well, at a certain point, I think I got to $250, I think was my highest.
Yeah, they would give pretty good raises. I mean, I think we did all right, but you're right. I would work with multiple writers and I would have multiple projects, and Straw Weissman was, you know, all of them. Nelson Lyon, he was a writer for Saturday Night Live and he was really funny. And he wrote great copy. Everybody was a little bit nuts, but they were they were the managers of the projects. We didn't get our projects from corporate. They they were the mediary between us and them, and they'd come to us. And we could vie for certain projects if we knew certain films were coming. We said, really want to work on that or not. And it was just a, you know, sort of luck of the draw.
Yeah.
And
yeah, you're going to have to work on Angel of Death, Kevin. Sorry.
We got good ones and we got bad ones. Angel of Death. Dave and I both worked on that. That was really
something. Operation Angel of
Death. Angel of Death is one of my favorites. It really is.
Mark absolutely loved Angel of Death.
They pasted the hair on the Nazi camp experiments.
Yes.
Mengele, they had hair pasted on their face.
It's like they had fake eyebrows on their cheek. It was just,
they'd repeat shots, certain shots of the film, you'd see them four or five times.
Yeah.
And we'd have one explosion from the movie. And when we do the trailer, we'd cut pieces of the explosion. Hopefully they had multiple camera angles, but we'd use the one explosion for punctuations throughout the whole trailer.
It was funny. I got to talk to Joe Dante a couple years ago, and I mentioned that I think it was an Operation Hit Squad, like the exploding helicopters. Like, we still used that. And I told him that. He's like, yeah, we used that. I'm like, of course, we used that too. It's like, it was still there, that exploding helicopter.
Yeah, I think it was they took it from CoverGirl Models, I believe. That's one where they exploded the helicopter. And then they realized that they could, anytime somebody would point a gun, they were like, we could just cut to that shot of the helicopter exploding and it would work.
We were still doing it in the late 80s. It's crazy.
This is, you know, I just watched, what did I watch? It Came from Outer Space or something like that. A 50s black and white space science sci-fi movie. They were doing it in those films for sure. There were multiple shots that were used multiple times. It's really funny to see that you're calling for, you know, the most exciting stuff you can get out of a movie. And if it's not there, you're going to do whatever you can to get it. You could take a shot and blow it up and it would become a new shot.
Yeah. Back in the day that, you know, you didn't, like now with Avid, you know, when Avid and Final Cut, you can do whip pans between cuts. But you couldn't do it back then. So if we ever saw a movie that had a whip pan, we'd save that and just throw it into a trailer. There's trailers with all kinds of whip pans from other movies.
New World can take credit for the whip pan in a trailer. Because we would pull those whip pans out of movies and use them without licensing it, because nobody could tell what it was from. It was just a color blur. Right. So we used whip pans as transitions between you know, sections of the trailer. It was really very effective. And the black frame.
Oh, yeah. You know?
Oh, the white frame. I'm
white
sorry.
Frame. The white frame. Because you couldn't make a white frame.
That's something that Alan Holzman told us, that he would put those into any kind of blast or any sort of like gunshot blast. He would add a couple, bit of white to it to just give it a little extra, you know.
Yep.
He used that for Battle Beyond the Stars and Forbidden World and all that.
Nobody notices those things, but they work. And the flutter cut. The flutter cut, where you do one frame cuts or two frame cuts really fast in between shots, you go boom, 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 boom. But it's not really like you're playing with it. You're using it just to get from one place to another. And flutter cuts are very, very big.
You mentioned earlier Nelson Lyon, and he did the trailer for Godzilla, right?
Yes.
The biggest
star ever. And then it shows Godzilla.
Yeah.
He did a ton of stuff.
He did Reform School Girls.
Reform School Girls.
And that copy line I still remember, and I thought it was brilliant. So good, so bad, so what?
That was his style. He would put that on everything. I was watching, I found some old stuff of mine. Like, there was a movie called Invasion Earth. Have you ever seen that?
Not yet.
Ah, so Invasion Earth is just a compilation of old movie scenes, like it came from beyond space, and but also this weird kind of wraparound interstitial stuff they shot. But Nelson's, the whole trailer I cut for Nelson is just all that. Nelson's whole thing was, he was just going to make fun of the movie. Hell Comes to Frogtown, he did that. he's just going to make fun of it. And they just let him do it. I mean, saying basically, this movie sucks. That was his whole thing. And it was great to work on because you're just like, I could just put anything here. And
that's actually a brilliant marketing strategy for mm-hmm. a movie like that. I think that that actually gets attention. You're not trying to bullshit anybody. You're not trying to make it look like something it isn't. And you know, if you tell people don't see this film, they're going to go see the film.
Right. Especially back in the day when you went to the video store, you didn't have the A-list movies. Remember? It was right. just like, you were just looking for anything on the shelf. And if you saw the Invasion Earth thing, you know, before you saw the thing, you might be like, all right, I'll watch that. I mean, it made sense at the time.
Yeah. And they were flooding the market with a lot of stuff just to try to, you know, with the early days of the video store era, they were trying to flood the market, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, they did.
And that's how In the Aftermath begins, right? That's how the sort of genesis of the movie is for that. Now, was the plan to actually release Angel's Egg once they got a hold of it?
No.
Yeah.
I just rewatched both films.
Me too.
Because it's been a long time, and
wow,
and really to remember exactly what the idea was. Well, here's the deal: Angel's Egg was a very sort of abstract, almost meditative movie that really has underlying messages of creation.
Mm-hmm.
Religion, fertility, it brings up a whole question about meaning of life. Now, these themes are not in that way really marketable in America. That's not something you can really sell. So what happened with Angel's Egg is we sort of denied the whole premise of that film, whatever, and rewrote all the dialogue for it and
right.
brought in, because it's animation, so you can, none of the dialogue's in sync if you watch it.
Right.
But mostly animation is kind of, you accept that. But anyway, so I was in the process with the writers. We were actually still writing dialogue during the mix.
Wow.
We had the voiceover.
You couldn't tell?
The girl. Yeah, in the studio while we were mixing, but basically really was trying to find a way to tell two stories and intertwine them. Now, there were certain things that worked quite effectively, I thought. I actually wound up with a new appreciation for In the Aftermath today.
Wow.
I did. I think it was a really, really hard assignment.
Yes.
To take a movie like that and try to incorporate a live action counter story, parallel story, and tie them together. Now, that's not easy when you just have imagery. Like, for example, in Angel's Egg, they have that sequence where the fishermen are chasing all the fish.
Mm-hmm.
In the aftermath, there's a moment where the guy who's actually Jesus in Angel's Egg, or God, with his cross over his shoulder and his taped hands where he's been crucified, telling her a story about a warrior who was in this world where there was all these fish, right? And it has no relevance to what we were doing in Angel's in aftermath, but it gave a means to go into that action sequence, which was the only action sequence there was. There were some very crude rotoscoping. There was obviously a very tight budget here.
Right.
So we did the rotoscoping of her appearing in the real world, mm-hmm. which happens, I think, twice or three times in the film. Obviously, the little girl plays her in real life. I think it really, and then the thing I loved the most about watching it again today was the animation changing in the hospital room that he was supposed to have drawn her.
Right.
That she suddenly changed, right, with the broken egg and trying to tie these two worlds. I felt that that was very effective. And it actually kind of works. Really hard, but what a project. I mean,
yeah, let's take a step back though. Angel's Egg comes in. Who is the first person to see it? Is it Carl who sees it and says,
or do you know Dave? I don't know.
I don't know how Carl, I mean, Carl's a really smart guy, so I have a feeling that they got it and they bought it because, you know, they probably saw a sales reel, you know, and they thought, mm-hmm. and the animation is incredible, right?
Yeah. Oh, it's beautiful.
They probably saw a sales reel and thought, hey, this is really great. And then they got
It's very Miyazaki influence. He was the total influence of animation at the time.
And I'm sure when they got the movie, they were kind of like, what the hell is this? And then somehow, I'm sure Carl, being the smart guy he was and wanted to direct, inserted himself into, well, maybe we should, you know.
It had to, yeah. You yeah, know? It had to start at corporate. Corporate knew they had to do something with it. So
I heard that some people said the rumor was it was too short, but then I looked it up. It's 75 minutes, and that doesn't seem like it's too short.
No, and
they never wanted to put that out theatrically, I don't think. It was always meant for video, even
an hour 11 minutes, and in the aftermath was an hour 8 minutes. So we didn't shorten it much.
No. Yeah, so I have a feeling they just thought it was incomprehensible to an American audience because, you know, this is back in the day, like, you know, when you couldn't even have Australian accents. Remember Mad Max, the original, was like, right. What the hell is this? And they even did it in Hellraiser, which still to this day just drives me nuts that I wish I had a copy of Hellraiser. The guy who plays Frank, you know, the guy who comes back, English guy, great accent. And they, if you listen to it, he's dubbed with an American.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're like, what the hell? Like, you guys don't, like... They tried to Americanize it. And at the end, the cops who come in, the movers are American. It was just silly. Like, why would you do that? And I had a feeling that after they picked that up, they were like, oh, Americans aren't going to understand this whole thing about Earth, Mother Earth, and everything that's kind of cool. And let's just, and Carl is smart enough to get in there and say, I should do it.
Okay. Hmm.
Yeah, so, and there was a lot of other people. Like, we had an assistant at New World named Gary Appleby, and he had a connection somehow. And he was British. He had a connection somehow with a guy who had done studio work with Pink Floyd,
like the saxophone player or something.
Yeah, he got him to do the score for this film, and so there was a kind of cool new soundtrack.
Yeah,
that we had to work with. So there was a lot of effort that went into trying to up this to an American audience, kind of, you know, presentable American audience film. And it was not at all when it was received. Now, with Carl, there were a number of people that sat, including me, and wrote this new script. And tried to put together this tie-in thing, and it was, you know, it was tricky, but it worked.
Because was there a script to begin with? I mean, I imagine there was a script when
there was minimal dialogue in Angel's Egg,
very sure.
So there really wasn't a script. What we wound up doing was trying to more tie-in imagery, like even the fight scene in the aftermath in the. In the old building where the guy that doesn't have the oxygen kills the one guy, and he has that
spear kind of thing,
matched sort of the imagery of the
cross. Yeah,
there were things that and the search for water. There was the water theme in both films. They're searching, you know, he's, you know, the guy, what's his name? I forget the actor, was drinking, they don't have oxygen. They don't have water. In a, you know, so there were these subtle tie-ins that I think kind of worked too, but no, there wasn't any script at all. I think we started from scratch.
So did you just start editing Angel's Egg once they had already shot the apocalyptic footage, or did it all start at once?
It did. We had to see the new footage and see what was created, and then I broke down the film, and a lot of it is completely nonlinear from the original film. There were certain sequences that were pulled, like the fish and fisherman scene, the fish shadows, But no, we had to look at it and sort of analyze it, break it up, and see, you know, what's going to happen here. She has to meet what now became her brother. And that happened very quickly. You know, the scenes in Angel's Egg were, some of those went on for 2, 3, 4 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, really kind of just imagery was very, you know, zen. We didn't make it zen. We made it, we changed the pacing. So yes, once saw what, and had a written script, and saw what was made and what this new dialogue was for the characters in the animation part, then we started breaking it down and putting it together in a logical sense.
And what was it about in like an apocalyptic setting, do you think that Carl was, why he was inspired to do that? Do you guys do it?
I think that it was the closest thing that he could come to with what appeared to me in Angel's Egg to be some post-war Eastern European city where Angel's Egg takes place. It's broken. It's shattered. So that was also a way to tie in thematically the imagery. That's why, and plus he probably had a good budget to go shoot in Fontana in that broken down mill. So I thought that was actually pretty smart, to have that kind of, post, apocalyptic.
Yeah. Yeah. Tom Dugan, the producer, told a story on the Blu-ray that, he said that they got the steel mill because, they went and talked to the guy and they had just rented it out for Terminator 2. And he told them what a great deal they got, and they got all this money from him. He was like, cool, well, we have $300. And they were like, yeah, well, we got a whole lot more for the Schwarzenegger movie. He was like, ah, that's great, but we have $300. So
apparently that place was toxic as hell, too.
Yes, like, yes.
A couple of, we had really two runners who worked on the movie, and they played in it as well. The end credits of In the Aftermath are half of post-production in those end credits. And they would come back and just say, like, just joke about how they were gonna, you know, be dying in a few years because it was just so gross there. Like, it was just nasty.
I'm sure.
Yeah, when the guy accepted the fee, he said, okay, just don't shoot over there because if there's a fire, we're not gonna know how to put it out.
Yeah.
That's funny. Yeah.
So this is Tom's story. I don't know if you guys did.
Makes perfect sense.
I hung with Tom a lot in those years, but I haven't seen him in a long time. I think they only shot there for 2 days.
I thought it was like 3 days. Yeah, it wasn't a lot.
It wasn't much.
Okay.
And I thought they did some pretty good coverage, you know, for what they had. I looked at one scene where they find a dead guy in a chair. And the guy picks up the magazine and looks at Surfer and then puts it back in his lap and it falls off his lap and they didn't retake it.
Yeah. So they're running and gunning. They're trying to get through it. They're trying to get a bunch of food.
They didn't have the luxury of Terminator budgets.
I'm just curious, you know, no right or wrong answer, but if you could do it again in the aftermath, what would you do differently, or what would you, you know, if you had it again and they said, okay, let's do it again, still use Angel's Egg,
start with the original film and create live action footage and try to make something out of it? I really can't say. I mean, I think that it was a really noble effort on our part, on the group of everyone involved in that. There was quite a lot of people involved in trying to make that happen. If I had it now, it would, I'm a different person. So I would analyze it differently. I would think about it differently. I would probably do a higher budget live action shoot and some, maybe some better special effects. And there's just so much more ability to tie the two together, you know, technically, that it could become something that was visually more appealing. Story-wise, you know, you can kind of create a story out of that. I would do it again.
I think you could lean into the spirituality a bit more of Angel's Egg than the cheesy Mad Max post-apocalyptic world. I think, again, same as you, understanding it more now than I did, you know, 30 years ago or whatever it was, you could lean in more to that.
You could lean into it an angle that you felt you had some scope with, right? You could also create some additional animation that was in that style.
Definitely.
So you could create new scenes. There's just, you know, technically so much more possibility, which I think is a really important part of doing a project like that, because, you know, how many films have done combination of animation and live action?
Not many. Well, and I ask purely out of, I loved it. I loved In the Aftermath. And
you did? Cool.
I did. I loved it.
What did you love about it mostly?
You know, to me, it, and I didn't, unlike Ryan and Mark, I didn't grow up with New World. I grew up in the Midwest, and I saw very few movies. Very few. It just wasn't a part of my family's
Your dad's
traditions.
Not a big,
it, wasn't a, it wasn't yeah. a big, so anything I sought out was like, oh, it was like a treasure and like a treat. Like, oh, I finally, you know, got to see a movie, or I stayed at a friend's house who, you know, was particularly well-to-do at the time. I had a VCR and I could watch something that they had recorded. You know, it was like, oh, I couldn't get it. I couldn't get enough of it. So watching this, it felt so ambitious. Like, my God, I can't believe that this was put together, because it just, I loved it. I loved watching it. And Mark and Ryan were teasing me because they're like, oh, come on, we watched, you know, so many different things. But to me, it felt so ambitious and it felt so unique. And is it perfect? No, but for what it is, it watching it spawned so many questions for me and so many thoughts. And it really stayed with me after the fact. Most of the time, I'll be honest, and you can listen to the podcast and know, I watch a movie, it's in and out. I'm watching, I'm like, okay, whatever. We talk about it, it's done. I don't think about it again. And this really stuck with me. And I really, that's, I think, what I appreciated the most was that with so little, it had such a big impact on me. And this was my first time watching it.
Okay,
I didn't know.
That.
So I was just curious if you could do some, you know. It felt like a labor of love in a way, watching it as a complete, I knew nothing about it. Ryan is the dome. He knows all the research. He and Mark, they know everything going into it. And I watch it from a truly kind of,
perspective.
That's really refreshing and awesome to hear. Now I got a secret to tell you, and I would never say this, but I feel like I should right now. Watching it today, after all those years, at the end, when the egg in the live action part, when the egg shoots the thing up in the sky, clears up, I felt a twinge of emotion. I did. I was surprised by it. And I'm not sure if it's actually the film or it was the sentimentality of the reminiscence of making this little, you know, thing that we did, but it was like, where did that come from? I can't explain it, but it was there. And I was kind of like, wow. Okay, so it worked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In its little simplistic way, it kind of worked.
Yeah. Well, just from hearing you talk about how you use the images and then blended it, like there was, it's interesting to hear you talk about it, because you guys put a lot of thought into what you would put from the animation into what you had. It seems like you looked at what you had in terms of the live action, and you looked, how can we weave that in so it all made cohesive sense as much as you could.
And
it's a difficult thing to do. And it's, Angel's Egg is such an interesting, you know, beautiful, interesting film, but it's not the apocalyptic thing, so it's but you had so much care. There was so much care that went into it, and I think that does
for sure
come across.
It was,
you know,
there was a lot of people that did care about this because it was difficult. So once you start, you're gonna give it your all, and it was that first shot when she drops the feather, and then you dissolve from the animation feather to the feather laying there in Fontana, where they pick it up and find it. That was the first thing that gave us some, you know, encouragement that we would be able to somehow dissolve between and try to match, you know, imagery. I thought the piano playing that he did at the end in the hospital, kicking into that montage between animation and live action, actually worked really well, although I have no idea where those sex scenes came from.
Yeah, I was wondering about that too. It's like, where was that?
That must have been Carl's weekend the week before. I don't know what that was.
Yeah, that was a bit confusing for me in the episode. I did not know.
Who was that woman?
I don't know.
But visually, okay. It actually, when you were really just going between the Fontana stuff and the animation, without that, it was subtle. There was only a couple of, you know, hand touches and things, but it was good.
Well, Erica, did it make you want to watch Angel's Egg at all? I mean,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I didn't even realize, I learned after the fact, that Angel's Egg was its own. I had no idea that it was its own thing. I thought the two were made for each other and then blended together. So I had no idea that Angel's Egg existed on its own as its own, you know, IP or whatever.
Right.
I'm just going to say what I loved about the imagery for me is I loved the difference of the rich kind of colors of the animation of the anime going into that stark. There's no color. There's no water. There's no mm-hmm. air. There's no hope.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm with you, Kevin. That rainbow shoots up into the sky, and for the first time, there was color, and there was hope, and there was, you don't know if they're going to be okay. Sure, they can take the mask off and breathe for a second, but like long term, are they okay? We don't know, but there's that hope, and I think that blending of now they have a little color, and the I'm right there with you. I was like, am I crying? I was touched.
I know, that's really awesome. I like that. I've never heard anybody talk about the film like that, or really never heard anybody talk.
Well, you just have to have somebody who grows up in a vacuum in Indiana see it for the first time in their mid-40s, and then there you go.
I have a funny story. Didn't you find out that Angel's Egg was huge, like in Japan? Didn't you?
I have a funny story about that.
Yeah.
I had my company. We had our offices in the Hollywood Athletic Club building on Sunset for a long time. And there was the athletic club at the bottom, and there would be events down there and gallery stuff. And I took a break one day and I went down there, and there was a show of Japanese art. And they had the whole area set up with beautiful paintings and all this Japanese art. And I walked into this one room, and they were playing in a small theater, Angel's Egg. And I came out and I talked to the docents there and the people running the gallery. And I said, oh my God, you're playing Angel's Egg. And I said, I cut the American version of that film. And they were like, what? Really? Oh my God. That movie, they told me, was like their Wizard of Oz. That popular.
Wow.
And me telling them that I worked on that film, I was suddenly like really famous. They invited me out to dinner. They wanted to hang out. It was really sweet and wonderful to see them celebrate that film like that.
Right.
It was a shock to me. I had no idea that it was that popular in Japan.
I think it does. I mean, it has a huge following.
Yeah,
it really does.
It's going to be coming out in 4K. So they
seriously,
is
it really?
I believe so.
Wow.
So what did you guys all know from the jump that this is just going to go for video? I mean, even though it was sort of
there was
in
never,
the later part of the 80s, was that was always what?
Yeah,
this
there was never
be.
Any plan to put that out theatrically. It just wasn't. I mean, at that point, you know. They weren't putting out a lot theatrically anyway, it seemed like.
Right.
They barely made their own movies. I remember easily the best script we ever got that they were going to make was Heathers. So we remember reading Heathers and thinking, wow, this is amazing. Why do we have this?
Right. That wasn't their model.
No, not at all.
And as creative guys in a basement, I think we were much more focused in on our work and what we were doing. I don't remember so much thinking about whether or not a movie was where it was going to be.
Sure.
I was involved in what I was doing, and whatever corporate was doing was another entity.
That but when you're the, when you're doing in the aftermath, though, you know it's going to be a video or straight.
Yeah,
to
aftermath was different because normally I did trailers. Doing a film was different. Yeah,
yeah, we knew that was going to be.
That was a direct. Yeah, we also didn't see it being theatrically marketable. It had to be a video release. It wasn't an important enough film.
You would pick up movies all the time and re-edit them, like Gunrunner, Telephone was one.
Right.
I mean, they would just get these movies and then just spend all this time and money just re-editing them and, you know, not really making them any better. It's just, I don't know. Like, I don't know if you guys have seen Gunrunner, but there's not much you can do to that movie to make it any better.
So do you think that they were trying to re-edit that movie? Were they trying to re-edit thinking they could make it better? Or did they just want to have sort of their imprint on it?
I think the objective was always that they thought they might be able to make it better, and that would equate to a better rental film, or if it was theatrical. There was probably always a financial reason.
Oh, sure. I mean, they didn't spend a lot. It's not like they spent a lot of money doing it, so there's not really that much of a risk, right? And if you put a nice box cover, maybe, you know, someone will rent it.
Yeah, I remember with Grunt, the wrestling movie, there was a theatrical opening, and at the premiere, they had wrestlers in a wrestling ring, you know, wrestling in front of the theater, and that was probably one of the bigger promotions that I remember them doing.
Yeah, and that was actually because of Alan Holzman. He insisted on doing that.
It was.
Because they were getting dumped, I think, in like Texas. Like, they weren't really pushing the movie, and they were just going to dump it in a couple theaters, like regionally. It's
always Texas, by the way.
Yeah.
It's always, you're always going to satisfy your contract that you have to open theatrically, it's always Texas, like one theater in Texas.
Yeah, why is that?
Oh, I don't know. It's just the weirdest thing.
Huh. And so he put together that whole, you know, had wrestlers and had the wrestling match and got reviews. And like they did that for one weekend to try to impress New World. And they were like, yeah, whatever. Yeah. And they were unmoved. And I don't think they even put Grunt. Well, they did put Grunt the wrestling movie out on video for a little bit, but it was kind of dumped at that
barely
point. Yeah.
Yep. I'm just remembering a premiere for a movie called Jake Speed. That was
Australian, wasn't it? Like
they were trying to promote this guy as a new top, you know, action actor. That
Raiders
that premiere was on the the ship down there in Long Beach.
Queen Mary.
Queen Mary. They had a big premiere at the Queen Mary, and that was a big deal. I mean, that they put some money into that premiere.
That's so when everyone was trying to make Raiders of the Lost Ark movies.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
As they should have.
Right. I mean, New World still had that Corman idea of, hey, this is big. Let's make one like it.
Yeah. Right. Follow the trends, right?
Exactly. Follow the trends. Exactly.
People love Road Warrior. Love Hell Comes to Frogtown. What's the difference?
Right.
And they had other movies. Remember, you know, they had actors. They had Codename Wild Geese.
Oh, yep.
Yep. Dude, they had an Altman movie. They were like, they must have been so happy. Like, hey, we got Beyond Therapy, Altman's new movie. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
Company, though. You know, I think it's so cool that you guys are focused on this company, because they actually also produced a lot of talented people, and they were significantly involved in the, you know, VHS rental market. That was a huge industry in that time. Oh, it was new. Everybody could have films. I mean, they found their niche, you know, right at the right time. They were there, and they just saturated it as much as they could. It was great.
When you were putting together In the Aftermath, though, was there any sense of the video market, sort of, as Dave was sort of pointing out earlier, like, at first, video stores came out and they needed stuff for their shelves. But as the sort of industry caught up with them, they had enough videos. They didn't just need to stock their shelves with just anything. Was there any sense of that making In the Aftermath that this maybe could, you know, not play as well as we think it might?
Not from my perspective. Because we were the creative end of it. I do have an associate producer credit, but it doesn't mean that I was really part of that decision making and thinking.
Oh, okay.
I was associate producing to create the film. I don't know if they started to recognize that switch.
But it does come out on video, New World Video, here in February 1988.
And don't forget, we owned Marvel at one point.
Mm-hmm. 87.
That's right.
They bought Marvel. And yeah.
Held
on to that one until around the time of 89 when the company starts to fall apart. They start selling off the parts of the company, and one of the first ones to be sold is Marvel. Though, they maintain the rights to make TV shows. So as New World got sold, the lawyers, like Larry and Harry, like sell the company off. But I believe it's Ron Perelman, who then basically runs with the company in the 90s. Yeah. And he's just making like the, you know, Hulk cartoons and RoboCop cartoons and a bunch of like Marvel stuff sort of makes that. And they start concentrating more on just TV movies and some Marvel cartoons, essentially, in the 90s.
Was that a profitable part of their company?
It was. I think what was ultimately profitable to Ron Perelman was owning TV stations. Because he started buying TV stations, and he had a bunch of those. So that sort of gets incorporated into New World as well. And eventually, Rupert Murdoch like takes over and buys up the company because he wanted to get all those TV stations.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in the mid-90s. But you guys were there for the end of the 80s, the end of the second ownership group. Like, what was that like? Could you sense that the air was coming out of the balloon?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you definitely knew that things weren't going good because all of a sudden you weren't working on three or four movies at a time. Started drying up a little. And the money, I mean, before it went under, I mean, like I said, there was money just flying around all over the place. And all of a sudden that kind of dried up. And just knowing what was going on in the industry, seeing what was happening, you could just tell that this kind of company just, it wasn't going to work anymore. Mm-hmm. Buying these movies that no one cares about and putting them on a video shelf when you can rent, you know, Star Wars, why would you rent that or whatever movie, you know what I mean?
Right.
So you
right.
could just tell it was going down. I mean, you know, money was flowing, it was flowing. I mean, it was insane what we could get away with in terms of, like I said, everyone was working on other things. I remember on Hellraiser 2, I was making, I don't know, $200 a day, $250 maybe at that point. And the vice president of marketing decided he wanted to do a trailer for Hellraiser 2 that had never been done before. He was going to pay me $10,000 to produce and edit it. I'm like, all right, I'll do that. And it was the dumbest idea ever. And I found it. I've never seen it online, but I found a copy of it. It's an audience reaction for a trailer. Like, no one had ever done that because it's dumb. Like, those, you would do audience reaction for TV spots after the movie had come out and blah, blah, blah. He wanted to do one for the movie before it comes out. It was the dumbest idea. So we did this thing. And I remember I submitted my invoice to my boss, Mark Pierce, for 10 grand. And he's like, make it 11 grand. We'll all go to the Ivy. I'm like, all right. So we made it for 11 grand. We all went to the Ivy. The money was just pouring out at that point. And at a certain point, you realize, that's not happening anymore. And we're not having as many movies come in. And all of a sudden, like all these other guys, like Nelson had started his own company. I went to work with him. And Straw Weisman had started his company. Kevin went to work with him. And Carl had gone off and started Cineville. And all these guys were starting their own companies and just kind of moving out. And you could just kind of tell it was just collapsing.
Were there any movies that they were talking about as like, this is the one, this is the movie that's going to get us out of our doldrums? This one's going to hit and we're going to be right back on track. Was it anything like that? Or was it just
we didn't have anything at that point. And at that point, I'll have to look at the years, but I mean, even Heathers, which was, I think, a great movie, that didn't do that well.
No,
I went to had to go to a screening to that. And I had to collect, it was up in like Santa Cruz or somewhere. And I had to help collect the cards for the focus group. And I had these women just yelling at me and how horrible it was. I'm like, I have nothing to do with this. Leave me alone. I'm just here to collect cards. People, it had a
real response to that movie. Like, people fucking hated that movie in a lot of ways because it was just so out there.
Yeah.
So that wasn't going to bring in any money. And that was probably the best movie we ever produced, I think, you know?
Yeah. And I think we talked about it in our episode, but I think, and this is just a theory, so I'm running it by you guys since you actually work there. But for me, I felt like the only reason Heathers really gets made is because the company was kind of falling apart and they just weren't paying attention to that. I mean, certainly they had to approve it to get made, but like, the reason like they didn't toy with it or mess with it.
No.
They only had really one big note about the ending.
They were shifting their focus to television. I think what happened.
TV was big.
They started to really let go of theatrical and they saw a better opportunity with television and we saw it. And I think that people started getting laid off. I noticed that, you know, the staff was pretty much of a beehive for a while and the staff was getting laid off and everybody was talking about what was going on. And we were aware that it was changing and we stuck around until we got other gigs and then we left.
Yeah. And Dave, you said you were there even longer. Were you there? Did you just show up one day and your key card didn't work? Or
there was another guy there we would joke about would be the guy to turn off the lights. It wasn't me. when Nelson started his company, I kind of went to work with him.
Okay.
So, and that was around that time where everyone was just jumping ship. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone was getting their screenplays finished.
Time, but, you know, talking about New World, I mean, it was an amazing place. It really was a training ground for so many people, and so many people got careers out of it. And the energy there, and the creative energy, and the people, you know, working together, there was something very special about that company. And I owe my career to them. I learned how to edit. I learned everything that I know from that, you know, that I knew at that point up till I left. It was really a training ground. It was a school.
Absolutely. And you got paid for it.
And you got paid for it and you had fun and you worked hard. I worked 16-hour days, definitely. And you know what? It was fine. We were all young. We were ambitious. And that company provided us with a place to hone our crafts and go on to have careers for, you know, our entire lives. It was awesome. That was a great place.
Yeah. And what do you think it taught you about marketing? Because you said you went into like movie marketing afterwards. And what did you carry with you from New World?
I carried the craft with me of being able to cut a good trailer.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the marketing that I learned. I started a trailer company in 1990 that is still running today, Seismic Productions. And my partner and I built it up from the two of us to a substantial agency. And learning about marketing came from that experience. My marketing chops were not really refined at all until I started working with major studios on bigger films and doing all that. But it gave me the foundation to understand enough to go that way and begin to learn, you know, more about, you know, demographics. And, you know, we were cutting, obviously you cut trailers for certain demographics. You cut for women under 24, women over 24, men, you know, the same things. And you target when you cut. So the marketing aspect of trailers and TV campaigns is, you know, an interesting way to approach. It's not just the creative stuff that we were doing at New World, which really didn't have a lot of that, from my opinion. Dave, do you remember doing? I mean, I did a lot of TV spots, but I don't remember us target marketing then.
No, I remember, you know, when testing started, because I remember when we first were cutting things, we just cut them until they said, "Hey, that's good, and let's finish it."
Yeah, there was a sudden, just cut this for young women. Show the guy with his shirt off.
All of a sudden, testing came in and it just upended everything. Like, oh God, really?
Testing became there was no client that could rely anymore on his own judgment. He had to rely on the marketing research that was given to him to try to target certain audiences and get the best possible opening of a movie.
And Dave, you'd said that you were asked to potentially cut for New World Television, but you were talked out of that decision.
Yeah, I was talked out of that. I was also talked out of doing advertising, commercial advertising, because it paid twice what I was making if you could be a commercial advertising editor. And I got talked out of that too, because I just love film. I mean, I got in the New World because I knew New World and I just loved movies. And it's like, I don't want to work. I mean, even though it was crime story was big at the time. What was the Vietnam one they had called?
Not Tour,
called
Tour of Duty.
Tour of Duty. That was kind of big, but it's just like, I don't want to do that. I just want to stick with film. And Mark Pierce, the guy who ran the trailer department, who later created Hammer Productions, which is still going on, which is a big trailer house, just said, listen, do you want to like look at 72 takes of a potato chip falling? Like, you don't want to do that. Like, you're right. I don't want to do that. And I don't want to work on TV. It's just like, why would I work on TV? I want to work on film. I mean, it's a big
but we're deal. Film lovers. We
and that's film, and back then man. TV
you don't
was
go to commercial yeah. advertising.
No, and back then TV is not what it is now.
Right, 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 right.
I mean, it was like that was like the low rent. Like, I don't want to work on that. Like, why?
Yeah,
yeah.
And so, when you followed Nelson Lyon, did you continue to still work in trailers too?
At that point, I've been working for trailers ever since. Yeah, Nelson. We worked on a. Until he became persona non grata basically in industry, we did a lot of trailers. He's a wild guy. Have you ever read Wired, the Belushi book?
I've saw the movie, but I never read the book. No,
the book. He was the last guy to see Belushi. He was there with Belushi all night, taking doing speed that weekend, actually, 3 days of doing those speedballs. And that woman, Susan Smith, I think her name was, is the one who introduced them. And then at the trial, he had immunity for testifying, and he kind of got blackballed out of the industry after that. Mm. And it was really tough for him. So that's why he was a copywriter. But at a certain point, I remember when I were working at other places, I'd say, hey, we should hire Nelson to do the copy. And I remember he did one for that Barry Levinson movie, Toys.
Mm-hmm.
Robin Williams, yeah. Like a wind up toy.
Robin Williams, yeah.
Yeah. And he submitted some copy, and it was the usual Nelson copy of this movie sucks. Like, you can't use this guy, it's crazy. And it was really hard.
An original, a true original, no question.
Yeah. One of the funniest guys I've ever met.
Yeah, really funny and outrageous for sure. And
you guys have seen the movie The Telephone Book that he directed, right? You should check it out.
Okay.
It's the only movie he ever directed, and it's crazy weird.
Okay. I haven't seen that one. I thought for a second you meant The Telephone, which we
no, talked but about he worked on the trailer for that. And Telephone, that's a whole nother story. Jim Malconian, who we still know, who was running the post production house, he was recutting that movie with Rip Torn, and he's got all kinds of crazy stories. That's a wild movie.
Yeah, because you said you recut it, and didn't Whoopi Goldberg like sue New World once they recut the
that
movie?
That sounds familiar. Yeah, she was not happy about it.
Yeah. Right.
But that movie was just a mess. Have you watched that movie?
Yes.
I haven't seen it.
I mean, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know that it was any better before the recut.
The movie is like mostly Whoopi Goldberg in an apartment talking on the phone.
That's a hard sell.
It's a tough one. It's a tough one. You know.
I'm sorry, but Angel's Egg got better when it was in the aftermath.
I don't know about that. It seems a lot more incomprehensible to me. Angel's Egg makes more sense to me now. I don't know why. Maybe I understood it better. Back in the day, I didn't understand it. And I kind of get it. Like, oh, it's all about Mother Earth and how, you know, you got to take care and all that kind of stuff, which I understand more now.
Oh, well, guys, this has been amazing. Yes. Thank you so much for your
thank
time.
You.
Just to close out, I just wanted to ask you guys, like, looking back, you guys got to spend some time watching these movies, kind of thinking a little bit about what is your, when you think back of your time at New World, what's your prevailing memory? What is something that you thought about that you probably hadn't thought about in a long time?
Dave, you want to go first?
You go ahead.
I think I sort of tapped into this before, but I think that it was a creative playground. It was a way to discover a new, I don't think when I moved back to LA and got into the film business that I had really any understanding of trailers. and filmmaking to that degree. It was a group of very creative people all together in one collective creative bubble, feeding off each other, making friends, lifelong friends. Dave and I met there. We've been friends ever since. I have four or five other people from that time that I'm still in touch with. It was a place to begin a different life for me. I started off in a very different world and transitioned into this one when I was about 29. And I'll never forget it. I mean, it was the place where my life changed. And there was great energy there. There was nothing but hard work and creative juice.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. And I think being, I think a big deal being separate from the Suits made a huge difference because, you know, I've been doing this as long as Kevin has for the last 35 years or whatever it is. And, you know, Suits just get in the way of creativity. That's the bottom line. Yeah. And not having them there, it just opened up this whole thing where you could just learn and do things without having someone looking over your shoulder. I never felt like I had anyone looking over my shoulder. If I could make Nelson laugh, that's all I was happy about. I'm like, great, he's laughing. He's gonna sell it, and that's fine. And that's all you would have to do. You wouldn't have to deal with these, you know, Suits, who I've dealt with ever since then. It's just not fun. I mean, and the other thing that really makes me very sad when I think about it is it's never going to happen again. This,
right?
There was New World, and there was also Canon, because I've met a lot of people that came out of Canon, and it was the same kind of thing going on there, where you could be do whatever you want in a way. So those were two schools of, you know, you're making money and I'm paying the rent barely, but I'm making money and I'm learning a trade that I didn't even know existed. People go to school now to edit trailers. I didn't even know what that was. What are you talking about? When I got the job at New World, it was because I want to be in production. I had post-production, production. Is there a difference? I don't know. I had no idea. And it just doesn't exist anymore. You just can't do that. And it's sad because there's so many careers going way back into Corman, obviously all the people he launched, but all the people he launched just from that group that we had that all went on to do things is really amazing. And it's just, you know, when you get creatives together, there's just an energy that's different, you know?
Yeah.
And it was just, I owe my career to that as well.
I think that what you're saying is true on a broader scale than just our experience. I don't think anybody could have that experience again. I think it doesn't exist. I think that corporate has taken over the film industry, and the creativity of it is taken a back seat. It's all franchise. It's all remakes. It's all safety production of doing things that they are trying to hedge their bets on making the most profit. Heavy, heavy, heavy. Running a trailer company through all the way through until, you know, now almost, it switched into a very heavy corporate pressure. Yeah. The freedom we used to have was gone 20 years ago. The freedom to have a client say, "I think that's really good, and we want to go out with that." Yeah. Doesn't exist.
Doesn't happen. It's really sad. I think, I work with a lot of younger people, and I was like, "Man, I wish you'd been around and seen how it was." I mean, it was
really, really
so much fun.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, we worked hard, but we had a lot of fun, and you know, we all went on to
creative
have careers. And that, it's just irreplaceable, and it's just not going to happen again. And it's just gone. And it's sad to say.
Those times are over.
Yeah.
Really lucky that we got to be there.
Yeah. I say that all the time. So lucky.
Yeah.
I will say that one of the things about doing this podcast and meeting people like you and just seeing how this company like reached and touched so many different people's lives.
Oh yeah,
has been kind of a fascinating thing to explore, and not what I thought we were going to be having those kinds of revelations when we started the podcast. But like, you know, even talking about in the aftermath, you guys talked about Allison Anders. She has, I read a quote from her thanking Corman, even though she never worked with Corman, but she was like, the people that came from him went yep. through New World, came yep. to me. And like, yep. she, you know, it's like the company just has reached so many different people.
Yeah.
And it's been very fascinating for us. I'll speak for all of us, that just to see how wide it is. It just, the more we go down the road, the more, the bigger that it just seems to be. Like the company had such a huge influence. So,
oh yeah. So, I mean, it was a college that you didn't pay for.
Yeah.
I mean, it was paid to go to.
I think yeah. that as time goes on too, that Corman was an incredibly influential part of the film industry that advanced from that point forward. He was very influential, and I think we all sort of got caught into that wonderful wave that was created from his ideas.
Yeah, yeah. I you know, when we passed on, we had Alan Holzman and Alan Arkush and Tony yeah, Randall.
Absolutely. That was really good.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, we had a little memorial talking about him. And it's just, I think the sad part is too, is also thinking that, you know, there, like you guys were saying, there, who's the next Corman? Like,
there's none.
And I don't know.
It can't exist in this world.
I don't know if, yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think people will maybe bring up, you know, Jason Blumhouse maybe, or Jason Blum, I should say. And but like, it's not quite the same as what Corman did.
You know? There's no one, there isn't a group of people working for Blum that are learning how to do this and learning how to do that, learning how to do that.
Right. Right.
It's not there.
Like, it's like you can't replace what happened with the rush of the incredible amount of talent coming out of Europe and America in the music business that happened in the 70s and 60s. I mean, those creative times and the freedom and the access, it's different. It's all just very corporatized now.
Yeah. Like I said, we had no restraints, really. I never felt any kind of corporate pressure, even though, you know, it was owned by, you know, three lawyers and run by Raimi. You just never felt that. So as soon as you left, when we left, when everything went to shit, then you started to realize, oh, this is what it's like? Jeez. Mm-hmm. Like, okay.
Yep.
You guys are doing a fantastic thing. And thank you guys for being the guys that are focused on this and have this love and appreciation for this company.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And we want to thank you and Dave for coming on the podcast. Dave, thank you for, you found us early on, and you know, you have been a big advocate of ours. You helped us connect us to Alan Holzman. So we are, you know, very indebted to both you guys. Thank you guys so much for being a part of this. This was, it's just been so cool to talk to you guys. So cool to talk to people that work for this company. It has been such a wonderful education. So we thank you for your time and thank you for sharing with us.
I'm over here like, don't cry.
Thank you for giving us the chance to talk with you guys too. This was great. You guys are awesome.
And that's it. That is our conversation with Dave Parker and Kevin Sewelson about In the Aftermath and New World Pictures in general.
They were so incredibly gracious in giving us so much time and sharing so many interesting, funny, insightful stories. I mean, I can't thank them enough.
And we could have talked to them literally, honestly. We, you know, you say that like we could talk to them forever, but really, we honestly could have kept talking for a very long time.
For sure.
We had 100%. It was so fun to talk to them and to talk to them about all the different movies in New World Pictures. What a blast! They were just thank you, Erica.
just so everyone knows, that isn't a soundbite that we're dropping into this episode.
No, she's truly Erica's truly Erica. Here. It's not just Mark and I. She's truly here. Oh, but again, thank you so much to Kevin Sewelson and Dave Parker. Hopefully, at some point, we can have them back. They were just terrific guys. We just had such a great time. Fascinating to chat with them. Insightful. just so so grateful to them. And
also, a good sign of an interview is when we stop recording. We talked for like another 10, 15 minutes.
We did.
There was a lot of fun stuff.
Yeah.
Of Dave's collection of props that he has from movies that he worked on.
Yes, he showed. He sent me a picture of the dog tags, the Death Before Dishonor dog tags.
Oh, nice.
So, nice. I mean, amazing stuff. So, hope you enjoyed this interview. So, thank you. Thanks again to them. And thank you guys for listening. If you want to listen to the rest of our dystopian summer episodes, go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. You can listen to all our episodes, read our articles, buy a t-shirt. You can also get yourself ready and prepared. Just highlight that page, because you're going to need to come back for Ha-Ha-Gist as we talk about all the comedies released by New World Pictures. It's going to be a fun month.
Some of the comedies.
Some of them. I mean, we couldn't fit them all in. Can't do it all.
Described by others as comedies.
What would be put on shelves in a video store in the comedy section. Technically labeled as comedies. But we'll be talking about some comedy movies, so check us out for that. We'll also have more interviews and more other special delights for you in our Ha-Ha-Gist selection. So make sure you stay tuned for that. And we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast. Bye, everybody.